WFAE streaming is funded by Garage Door Guru, providing local comprehensive garage door service for over 12 years, including detailed repairs and door installations, offering fine German-made garage doors. Details, go garagedoorguru.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We think of Biltmore House as the preeminent example of Gilded Age architecture in the state, but that would be wrong, and those of you who take part in the Salisbury Historic Homes Tour will discover a house that served as a kind of prototype for other homes of that period, including George Vanderbilt's Biltmore House. More on that later in the program. First, another classic, Puccini's Tosca. It is the opening production of the 64th season for Opera Carolina, and we're going to explore this work, last produced here in 2005, and which contains some of Puccini's most beautiful music. That music promises to be brought to life in a special way due to the appearance of two of our guests this hour. Jill Gardner is a soprano powerhouse who has received countless rave reviews from around the country for her interpretation of Floria Tosca. She leads the Opera Carolina cast and joins us now. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Once again, before we even begin the conversation, you have proven I am right about opera singers. I have never spoken to an opera singer that I didn't like almost instantly, because you are unlike what everybody thinks opera singers might be like if they had never met one.
Well, that's lovely. I'm so excited. What an entrevue here. Yes. We love opera.
Yes. Also with us is Metropolitan Opera tenor Raoul Melo, who appears frequently on Garrison Keillor's A Prairie Home Companion, but primarily appears at leading opera houses around the country, including the Metropolitan, obviously. Good morning. Welcome to you as well.
Good morning. Thank you very much for that.
You're welcome. And Maestro James Mina has returned. He's General Director and Principal Conductor for Opera Carolina. Always good to see you as well.
Morning, Mike.
You're not here enough, by the way. I just want to bring that up.
I'm not in Charlotte enough these days.
Why did you choose this to open the 64th season?
You know, Mike, the top 10 operas are sort of on a rotation. Every season that we construct has to have at least one anchor to it.
And who made that rule? You?
Well, no, actually, the laws of economics make that rule. You know, when we look at our budgets, we know one of the operas has to be a surefire sell, mm-hmm. a popular piece that we know.
It pays for the others.
That pays for the others, essentially. And then that gives us the latitude to program things like the Pearl Fishers, which closes the season. So I don't want to say it was Tosca's turn, but it was kind of Tosca's turn. And we're also in the second year of a Puccini cycle. The company's going to produce and perform all of Puccini's operas between The Madame Butterfly that we started last January and spring of 2017.
We had Stephen Brown from The Observer and Larry Topman from The Observer on earlier this week to give an arts preview, and that's one of the things that came up off the air. And they asked me to ask you, is it really true that you intend to produce every opera Puccini ever wrote? Every opera?
Yeah.
And even the less familiar ones?
Right. The two early pieces, Le Villi, which is the first piece, and then Edgar, which was it's a very flawed piece. We may do Edgar in concert or semi-stage, because it's really an awful libretto and it doesn't really work on stage. But we're going to do the piece. Le Villi actually works as a ballet pantomime, and actually does work on stage. So we're just determining when we do those pieces. We'll probably do both of those lesser-known works at the Knight Theater. Uh-huh. So there's a lot of scheduling that we still have to do, but the company is fully committed to doing this.
Jill and Raoul, how unusual is it for a regional opera company like Opera Carolina to tackle something like this, to do every single work a composer ever wrote?
It sounds like exactly what the maestro would do. I mean, I call him the hardest working man in show business.
There we are.
It sounds perfectly reasonable, because there are very few. There's two operas that are not performed so often. That's it. Everything else he wrote is in the standard repertoire. That's a batting average that almost no other composer has.
Now, we've talked with singers who've come through here before to perform with Opera Carolina, and it is quite clear to anybody who takes the time to look that you folks travel the country, travel the world in some cases, singing different roles. Some are in your repertoire that you repeat over and over again because you're known for those roles. Others, not so much. When did you, and these are all arranged years in advance, when did you first know that you were coming here to sing Tosca, Jill?
I think it was about a season and a half ago, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think to go back to the previous, which to address that point, there was a time, I mean, we are, you know, in a new economic territory, and there was a time in the business where, people were booked, you know, 3 to 5, you know, sometimes more than that, out as far as seasons are concerned, 3 to 5 years. But we're in a very interesting time now where, you know, it takes companies longer to, you know, accept budgets and to define money boundaries. And what I think, to go back to the question that you just asked, what I think is really a wonderful artistic choice on the part of Maestro and Opera Carolina is that clearly by choosing to do all of Puccini's repertoire, that's a wonderful artistic choice. And it's like a terrific art exhibit, you know, that's showcasing an artist's work. For an area like Charlotte, to be able to know within this time period that they have the opportunity to hear all of the major works of this composer, I think that's a beautiful artistic choice. And in a time when we tend to only look at things economically or what's the bottom line, I'm excited, particularly as a Puccini singer, to know that somebody's doing that and is making that be the raison d'etre instead of the bottom line.
Although you've already spoken off the air Italian and on the air, on the air French, and with both correct accents, I'm detecting a little southernness in your voice.
A little?
Where are you from?
I know I hail from Tobaccoville, North Carolina.
Really?
Yes, a little town north of Winston-Salem, so... It's a delight that Maestro brought the homegirl home, as I said yesterday at the wonderful Verity Society coffee.
Now, of course, Raul is really from the South.
You're absolutely.
You're from
very
Cuba.
South, yes.
You're from Cuba.
Way south.
Yes, way south.
How did that happen? How did somebody born in Cuba end up in the United States singing opera?
Why not?
Well, yes, but I'll tell you why not. Because it's hard to get out, we are told.
Well, but I... The getting out was achieved through my family in Spain. So, you know, that's a long, tedious story. But I'm basically an American. I was raised here my whole life. And
because I was going to say, you're the only one here without an accent. So.
Yes, I sound like I'm from Findlay, Ohio, actually.
Yes. Good one.
Floria Tosca, the title role, is an opera diva. The character is an opera diva. And yet I have read a previous review of a previous performance of U.S. Tosca, and it said there was little of the grand diva about her, which made your portrayal all the more human.
Mm.
Interesting decision then. Why? Because it would have been very easy to become the diva.
Well, sure, and what's great about the particular production that we're doing with our stage director Jay Lessinger, who has also been terrific to work with in the rehearsal process, is that he, I think, is, you know, splitting the difference in the fact that Tosca, she has ascended to a level not only in her artistry but within the social structure of Rome at this time, where, you know, she is a diva, and she's celebrated for that, and she's a well-known singer, I think a beloved singer in the area.
And are we reading into the word diva things that we shouldn't be reading into them?
Yeah, but because I think that it's sort of like her, as I say, we all understand that is her position. But in this 24-hour time period that Tosca actually, less than 24 hours, but in this 24-hour time period that Tosca actually happens, the plot of Tosca actually happens within, what you actually experience of Tosca is a lot of private moments where we're able to see aspects of her character that she might not show in the public arena, sort of like a star today. They have their public personas, and then they have their private lives that the tabloids love to exploit.
Mm-hmm.
And in this situation, the Tosca, you know, at the top of Act Two is actually singing a very celebrated cantata for a military victory that happens, or that Rome thinks happens at that time. And she, that scene happens actually off stage. And then we come into Act Two when she enters Scarpia's chambers at the Palazzo Farnese, and we're in a whole different world. And she finds herself within a whole different world that ultimately draws on survivalistic and primal instincts that any real artist utilizes in their work.
Right.
But we actually get to see her, you know, come from that point. Because you have to remember that the character of Tosca, like a character like Nedda, was an orphan. She came from the dirt. She lived and, you know, survived as this homeless person, shall we say. And the nuns found her and discovered this incredible musical gift that ultimately the Pope bestowed upon her to go out into the world to share. So
for those who don't know the story, this is the rise and fall of this particular woman. You know the backstory, and then you see her fall in love, and the love goes awry for reasons that we can or cannot go into. I don't want to spoil the plot for people here.
Well, exactly. But I think, yes, it's a, you know, and also everyone dies. I mean, this is the incredible thing about this piece.
Don't they always die?
Not necessarily. You know, there's a great rule in the opera house. You can tell a good opera by the body count at the end of the evening. So
this is an
especially good one because we have three deaths on stage and visible for everyone.
And on Gelotti, another character.
Actually, four. You're correct.
Yeah, he does also commit suicide. So,
but that's
also off stage. So,
yeah, but the thing, Mike, just quickly, you know, the wonderful thing about Puccini's operas, and this is something that each of the operas has, is the characters are very real. Even though in this case she's a celebrated diva, Cavaradossi is a celebrated artist, a painter. They are real people. And the dramatic situation they go through is very human. And I think this is one of the reasons why Puccini's operas are so beloved, because we understand these characters on a very, very essential, primal level.
I was going to ask you, Raul, because you play this revolutionary painter, Cavaradossi, who falls in love with Tosca and who ends up in dire circumstances as a result of that romance. It's almost like a soap opera, an American television soap opera, or maybe even a novella if you want to take it to that level. But you have to make these characters work for a modern audience, right?
Well, the people's emotions don't change. People feel the same amount of love, hate, envy, lust today that they did in 1810. The story doesn't change. You can take this exact story, take out the music, and it'll be a fabulous movie of the week, if they still did those.
Because there are only seven plots. No, that's true. I think that's true. I think some famous Greek playwright said there are only seven plots, and he was right.
And it's the situation that Cavaradossi finds himself in is that he's helping a political prisoner, and it's the helping of this political prisoner that drags everyone down, including Tosca. So it's that conflict between the authoritarian government and the people that are fighting for freedom, in this case personified by Napoleon. So actually a big player in this opera that is way off stage by a thousand miles is Napoleon's army.
Wow.
Who's conquering Italy.
So this is the opera takes place in 1810, but it was written in, what, 1903? Or
yes.
It was produced first in 1903?
Produced first in 1903. The opera actually takes place on June 17th, 1800.
Yeah.
Wow.
Specific date in history.
Okay. My bad.
You know, it's okay. You're the tenor. You're allowed to make a historical mistake. We're not going to hold that against you.
We have to stop for a second. We're coming right back with Jill Gardner, Raul Melo, and James Mina. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and AC Entertainment, presenting Bonnie Raitt live at Ovens Auditorium on Thursday, October 11th. Tickets available at 1-800-745-3000 or at Ticketmaster.com. And Enfocus Magazine, a 20-year-old publication now covering the Charlotte philanthropic community. The October Arts Issue is now on stands in select Harris Teeters and local businesses. Nearly 5,000 people were lynched in America, and mostly in the South, between 1882 and 1968, with most of those victims during this long period being African-American men and boys. There's a new exhibit at the Levine Museum of the New South that focuses a lens on that period, literally. It's an exhibition of photographs documenting dozens of hangings. We'll explore that exhibition and talk about the history of it all Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, fallout from the first presidential debate, a first look at September unemployment numbers, and Pennsylvania's voter ID law is blocked. Behind the week's top stories, what happened and why.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, your NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Opera Carolina's opening production of their 64th season, which opens on the 13th of October. That would be next Saturday night. The following Thursday, the 18th, the following Sunday, the 21st, in the Belk Theater. Jill Gardner is Tosca. Raul Melo is Cavaradossi. You weren't spurned, but you're the lover.
I'm the lover who
paying the price.
I pay the price by, how can I put this? I choose to help a friend, and that kind of gets everyone in trouble.
Okay. Happens all the time.
Yeah.
And James Mina is the principal conductor for Opera Carolina. You have described Tosca, James, as through composed. And I know what that means in musical theater. That's where one song goes into the others. There's
right.
very little dialogue. And if there is any dialogue, it's done over the underscoring, mm-hmm. which continues on. And some songs are designed not to get applause.
Right.
That's musical theater. What does through composed mean in opera?
Exactly the same thing, Mike. The basic formulas that we use in opera are exactly the same as in music theater, only in opera, instead of having spoken dialogue, we will have sung recitative. Mm-hmm. In the earliest forms of opera, those forms are very clearly defined. You have the dialogue set to music, which is recitative. Then you have the set pieces, arias, duets, quartets, whatever. And that's actually opera is the plural for works in Latin, opere. And it's really just a series of works that are strung together with a dramatic through line.
But so aren't all operas like this?
All operas are like this. But in a through composed opera, the ending points of the arias, the ending points of the recitatives, are then merged with the starting points of the next number. So that you get a sense that there is no stoppage
yeah.
whatsoever.
But opera has a tradition of people who love a certain performer or love a certain aria who want to stop the show and give cheering standing ovations and maybe even an encore of the aria.
Yeah.
Sometimes
the composer actually makes that happen within the confines of the opera. You can tell at the end of Vici d'Arte, for example, it's clear that the music stops and as a point for taking applause. But then there are other points, like after Raul Cavaradossi's first aria in Act One, where Puccini clearly doesn't want you to stop. The music keeps going. And in fact, fortunately, Raul is amenable to this. We're not going to stop. We're going to keep going. And if the audience applauds, let them applaud, and we're just going to keep going so that we get a sense of that dramatic through line.
Well, you mentioned Vici d'Arte, which is part of one of the things that you sing in Act Two, Jill. And it was described by Opera News in your hands, not only as a showstopper, but an opportunity to reveal layers of Tosca's character. We're going to hear a bit of the opera as sung by Maria Callas, because we don't have a recording of you singing at the moment.
Dear Maria, I bow to her.
Okay, so we'll hear a part of that, and then I want you to talk about how you peel back the layers of this character in the course of Vici d'Arte.
Sincera,
So give us the recipe for peeling the onion. How do you reveal her character in the course of singing this?
Well, it's a beautiful moment actually in Act Two for her after realizing this violent relationship that is being peeled away with Scarpia, who is a very evil man, and he is ultimately going to demand of her that she thinks for the freedom of her lover that she is going to have this sexual encounter with him. That some people would say he's basically going to rape her, mm-hmm. and Tosca knows that this is going to happen. And right prior to this aria, Scarpia has put me down on the floor and basically said, "Do you not hear what's happening outside in the street? They are putting up the gallows that we're going to ultimately hang your lover and this political prisoner Angelotti from, you know." And this is what is happening. And Tosca is in many ways a very devout person. She again, from her primal instinct, she has a purity, and she goes to God in this aria and basically asks, given everything that I've done in my life, given all the things that have happened to me, why? It's like, why do bad things happen to good people? Right? That eternal question.
So this gives you a chance to use your acting chops.
Yeah. And I, you know, and for me, what I love about being a singer are words. Uh-huh. I'm driven by the text of the things that happen. And what she says in this is just really, it's fantastic, you know, in some ways existential questions, but the truth of those existential questions always lives within the circumstances that you happen to be living at that moment.
As we've alluded to, you've done this role before, and you've been really highly favorably reviewed in this role. I'm sure that you have played Cavaradossi in the past. When you go from opera company to opera company and you reprise these roles that are in your repertoire, you're working with different conductors, you're working with different stage directors. How does that change or inform your performance? Or are you expected to turn in your version of the character, come hell or high water?
That's how things used to be, and I apologize for nodding my head last time. I mean, the audience cannot hear me nod my head. It used to be, not only did you come in with your performance, you came in with your own costumes. That was the bad old days. You had your costumes for your and you had your performance. What was it? Melly Nelba used to send her maid.
Yes, right.
For the staging. Mm-hmm. Tell people she's going to stand here for Act One, the aria, and then she'll stand here for the duet. And the maid would just tell them where she's going to be. That's, again, the bad old days. So everything's different. Drama is so much more important to the drama per musica version of opera that we do today. And so you have to kind of bring your A game and rebuild who you are, your character, work within the structure of the production that you're in. Every production has a different feel, a different thrust, a different atmosphere to it.
And you have to adapt to that.
You have to adapt to that.
You're willing to adapt to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, to have the flexibility.
Yeah.
You've been described to me, James, Mina, as an opera purist.
That's not true.
No, well, it's not.
I don't think so.
Well, okay. If you're not, then that ends the question. Thank you for being here.
I don't know. Kids, am I a purist? I don't know.
But given, let's just for the sake of argument.
Maybe it's like diva. It doesn't really mean bad thing.
That's right.
You're very protective of the form. You love the form, very protective of the form.
Yeah.
And we're just hearing about the bad old days versus the good new days, and now that drama has superseded the old way of doing things, is it difficult to adjust? I mean, this is all obviously coming because of modern technology and modern expectations driven by movies and television and our exposure to other forms. So how difficult is it for a purist to make these accommodations?
It's actually very easy, Mike, if you are – if you're centered in what you want to accomplish with the art form. This is the amazing thing about great art, whether it's opera or whether it's a great Beethoven symphony or a great painting. They are so rich that they actually can survive as great works of art even in bad productions. But if you're true to the piece, if you understand what the opera in this instance and what Puccini wanted, you can find new ways of recreating these works which are true to the work, which then speak to contemporary audiences. That may sound, you know, kind of like a convoluted answer, but what we're doing at the opera now is changing the way we do productions so that they are more dramatically centered, more visually compelling, and yet they're still true to the character and the nature of the piece.
And you did last season, Madama Butterfly, with sets by Jun Kaneko,
yes,
who was on this program.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's how you say his name.
Mm-hmm.
A beautiful, stunning, artistic-driven set. And yet I understand that there were some people who are regular Opera Carolina patrons who didn't appreciate that.
Oh, no. I would say a percentage, hopefully a small percentage of the audience that really didn't like that production.
Because it got rid of the little house. And
yeah, you know, they were lots of times folks who love opera and who know opera come to the opera with a certain set of expectations. When they see Madama Butterfly in that instance, they want the house and they want the bridge and they want, you know, the things they're used to.
Mm-hmm.
And what Kaneko did, obviously, was turn that whole concept on its head. But I found his production extremely compelling. I thought it was very true to the piece and actually helped illuminate the piece beyond the normal confines. That doesn't happen all the time with new productions.
And you're bringing his artistic vision to the Magic Flute this year.
And interestingly enough, Mike, you know, we co-produced that new production with San Francisco Opera. And I went to San Francisco. It premiered in June, and we perform it in January. And I found their production, the production elements in San Francisco, actually went against Kaneko's designs and Mozart's intentions. So we're making changes here to the production and the way we perform it to make it more of a unified whole. Mm-hmm. That's the hardest part with opera. Is as you're taking this very rich art form and adapting it to contemporary tastes, you still have to keep it true and relevant and make it exciting for audiences.
It seems to me that you walk a very fine line or a very tough line because it's collaborative, but there are so many considerations. You've got the original intent of the composer. You've got the expectations of the audience for these pieces that they've heard 100,000 times and maybe have seen a lot. And then you have your vision as the conductor. We have the vision of the performers who you've brought in here who have great resumes, and then you've got the stage director's
vision.
How do you bring it all together and be on the same page at the same
time? That's what's fun
about
it. Don't
you think government could learn from art?
Yes. Now, Raoul, you not only perform at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, but you perform Metropolitan Opera, excuse me. Perhaps you have sung at the Museum of Art.
I actually have never made it to the Museum of Art, sorry. I'd like to, though. They have a lovely jazz series on Friday nights.
But you sing for the Metropolitan Opera and you sing for companies around the country. The Metropolitan Opera is kind of the pinnacle, I would think, for opera singers in this country. So once you've been to the Met, how do you get back to the farm?
You know what? Quality is quality. It doesn't matter where it is. I mean that, and I'm not just saying that. I mean this is a very – these are as good a cast as you will find at the Met, really. And quality is quality.
Okay.
It doesn't really matter where it is. On the other hand, there are times when I'm used to making really big steps because you've got like 70 feet to cross all the time. So I was in the first days of rehearsal. I started walking across the stage and the director was saying, that's too far. I said, oh, you're right. It's a 30-foot wide stage, not 50, it's 50, not 70 or whatever the differences.
You have to make some adjustments.
And, you know, if I can jump in here on that level, too, I think what's also important to at least acknowledge for audiences across America is, you know, I think that the Met is oftentimes seen as the pinnacle, and in so many ways it is, and it does offer the kind of artistic quality that it offers, and it has its HD broadcasts and performances, which hopefully are building audiences. But I think as a singer and as an artist, I do want to give a shout out to the regional companies of our country that have always had as their modus operandi the need to bring quality to their local audiences. And that's how you also build appreciation and love for opera. So quality is quality.
I want to play another aria right now, as a matter of fact, if you'll start it, Wendy, that is probably one of the more famous pieces of music in opera, and it's something that Raoul, your character, sings during Tosca. I'm going to listen to a portion of it, and then we'll talk very quickly about what's going on here and how you approach singing this particular piece of music, which is, as I said, incredibly famous.
Ed olezzava la terra, stride all'uscio dell'orto, e un passo sfiorava l'arena, entrava la fragranza.
So what's happening here?
Well, all of these things we call arias, they're little songs that take place in opera, are soliloquies. They are either internal or external, either telling people a story that you want them to say, okay, here's the story I want to tell you, or you're telling the story to yourself. In this moment, he's reliving the last time they made love. They met in his garden. Which, you know, sounds lots of fun to me.
As long as there's no poison ivy.
Well, that's why it's a garden. It's the garden, not the yard. But does Italy have poison ivy? I don't think they do.
Probably not.
he's reliving this moment of extreme happiness and joy and love. And then now he goes, but instead, e muoio disperato. I'm dying in desperate. Desperately. No.
In desperation.
You're in desperation. I'm dying in desperation.
And that is the crux of opera: the deep drama emotion. And emotion. Raoul Melo plays Cavaradossi. Jill Gardner is Tosca in the opera Tosca. James Mina is the principal conductor for Opera Carolina, and it opens on the 13th, next Saturday night of October, at the Belk. It plays again on the 18th, Thursday, and Sunday the 21st, 704-372-1000 or operacarolina.org for tickets. And this is the first of three operas, Magic Flute and the... help me out here, Jim.
The Pearl Fishers.
Excuse me, later on in the season. Thank you all for being here. Once again, you've proven opera singers are fun.
Thank you, Mike. We are fun, and you are too.
Coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Cleveland County Arts Council, hosting the 10th Annual Art of Sound Music Festival, October 11th through the 13th in Uptown Shelby, North Carolina. artofsoundcc.org. Fallout from the first presidential debate, one of the major topics of discussion in the national hour of the weekly news roundup at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. Also, a first look at September unemployment numbers. They're down. And Pennsylvania voter ID law is blocked. Diane Rehm and her guests will talk about that and many other stories in the first hour of the Diane Rehm Show, then the international hour at 11 o'clock. And that's all upcoming right here on 90.7 WFAE.
Hi, I'm Alex Chadwick. In Pennsylvania this election year, people are talking about energy, natural gas, and the controversial drilling technique known as fracking.
When it all first started, I had no idea what was going on. I had never heard of hydraulic fracturing before that.
She's heard of it now, and you will too, next time on Burn, an energy journal from Sound Vision Productions and American Public Media.
Sunday night at 7 at 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. From one classic to another, home tours seem to be a favorite pastime with lots of folks in this area. But when you have the opportunity to tour historically significant homes, that pastime provides even greater pleasure. Well, get ready for the historic Salisbury Foundation's 37th annual October tour. I did not know this till yesterday, but Salisbury was a frontier town. Daniel Boone started his wilderness journey there in 1769. Andrew Jackson studied law there, and I'm going to say something that's going to get me into trouble here now. Unlike Charlotte, much of the history of Salisbury remains. They haven't torn it down. In fact, tour goers will be able to see a home that served as a kind of prototype, I guess, for many of the other homes of the rich during the Gilded Age. George Vanderbilt, for instance, I believe, patterned his Biltmore House a little bit after a home on the Salisbury Home Tour. And here to tell us more about that and other attractions on the tour scheduled for next weekend is Brian Davis, Historic Salisbury Foundation Executive Director and author of a book called Lost Galveston, which is about similar homes of a similar vintage in Galveston, Texas, correct?
Correct.
Not a place that I would equate with homes of that vintage. Actually, I looked through your book. It really surprised me. There's some beautiful homes down there from this period.
Thank you very much. Yes, this is I've actually been executive director at Historic Salisbury Foundation for the past 6 months. Okay. Prior to that, I was at the Galveston Historical Foundation for 7.5 years as their director of preservation services. But during that time, as we do research and it's part of our job, is to start to figure out these clues to the past. And seeing some of the photographs of houses and buildings that were just magnificent that were obviously no longer still standing kind of begged the question for me as where were these and what was the story behind that and how did they meet their demise? Mm-hmm. And so that's what kind of the inspiration for the book came along.
And also with us from Historic Salisbury is Christine Wilson. You're the event coordinator of the tour, which from what I've read about it means you haven't got time to be here today.
You're exactly right. There's much still to do.
And Susan Sides is president of the Board of Trustees of the Historic Salisbury Foundation and author of another book, very much like Brian's, Historic Salisbury and Rowan County in Vintage Postcards. It's full of pictures of Salisbury and Rowan County and buildings, some of which still exist, some of which I imagine do not.
Correct.
Welcome to the program. Nice to have you with us. Salisbury, unlike some towns, we'll go unmentioned even though I've already done it, seem to have done a pretty good job, actually a really good job, of historic preservation. How did that come to be, Susan?
Largely because of the vision of Edward Clement. He was the founder of Historic Salisbury Foundation, and he started 40 years ago. The foundation was formed April 12th of 1972. And through his vision, it has grown, and many, many properties, over 100 properties, have been now have covenants on them for their protection, and we continue to this day.
But anybody who believes, as he did, that this is important is up mm-hmm. against commercial forces and the ever relentless march of progress. Mm-hmm. How do you get buy-in from citizens who may see things differently? Let's take that down and let's put up a Walgreens.
Mm-hmm. It's a very difficult situation because people want progress, and yet the Historic Preservation Society in Salisbury is a very strong organization. We have a national reputation. We have a preservation-minded community. So there are many individuals, like the one house on tour, the Hambley Wallace House, that's an individual effort rather than a foundation effort. Mm. There are many individuals in the community who have done like projects. Mm-hmm. Another site on tour is the Yancey Hardiman Building. That was a private individual, not the foundation. So we've got a preservation-minded community.
Now, go ahead, Brian.
I think a lot of this is really showing the potential that historic buildings don't necessarily have to work against progress, that actually there's a lot of potential still left in the amount of labor and materials and just cost that is involved in building these originally, and just the quality of the materials that the buildings still hold.
Yeah, they don't build houses like that anymore.
For many reasons. No. I mean, the craftsmanship is, a lot of times it's lost, or just the quality of materials. Like right. Today's, for example, the timber that is used and that you buy today is a hybrid that is designed to grow fast so they can harvest it more often. But whereas you're talking about old growth timber that was used 100, 200 years ago.
Yeah. Right?
So it's not the same.
You came from, as we said, Galveston, Texas. And in your book, at least, it appears that there are scads of historic houses preserved. How does the number of houses, I don't know how big Galveston is compared to Salisbury, but how do the numbers compare?
Comparatively, Galveston's about 47,000, whereas Salisbury is around 33,000. So it's on about 1.5 times the size of Salisbury. It's a little barrier island. But actually in the book that, and it's one thing to, when you're able to hold a book and say that every building in this book is no longer standing, even though there were some magnificent buildings, but there are still some that survive. But that also
say,
kind of
Galveston gets hit by lots of hurricanes.
It is, and it's just a matter of living along any coast. It's right. It's not a matter of if the next storm will come. It's just when.
So, now, as I understand it, and I believe we've done a program in the past with the historic Salisbury Foundation. And if I recall correctly, the foundation was established as a fund for endangered structures, things that would have gone by the wayside. How has that money, or how is it being used today? How has it been used in the past? How is it being used today?
That's what's referred to as our revolving fund. There are funds that are used for the preservation or the stabilization of a structure. Mm-hmm. We then market that structure, sell the structure, and the proceeds from that go into the revolving fund to take on another project.
And how do you decide which buildings are deserving of being preserved and which buildings were okay, they were okay in their time, but now it's time to take them down and
put
something else
out? If it is either historically or architecturally strong, we would look for that. And we've most recently been able to purchase a home from 1820 that was damaged by fire back in 1984. But it's a wonderful structure, and we're very excited about the acquisition of that. It's the Fulton Mock Blackmer home in Salisbury.
One thing I can add to that is that the revolving fund is also, it's a huge economic tool for the community. Over the past 40 years, Historic Salisbury Foundation, with a revolving fund, has saved 100 buildings, but that equates to, on the current tax rolls in Rowan County, over $7.5 million, where otherwise many of those lots would be vacant because buildings would have deteriorated and just be vacant lots.
So talk about the economic piece of this puzzle. What is the economic impact, and why is there an economic impact? I mean, the tour is 2 days.
It
there is. Are 363 other days in the year. So how does it keep on giving?
It's a chance for people to visit a historic small town with historic character and charm and realize that, you know, I don't have to be tied to location for a lot of times with their jobs. If they can telecommute or if they're their jobs, they can travel. We're really only about a half hour drive, 45 minute drive out of Charlotte. So very attainable location.
Some people who travel on 85 get off the interstate and grab a hamburger. and like any town in America, the exits around the roads around the exits of interstates are filled with fast food restaurants, and that's it. And that may be as far as deep as you go into Salisbury, but I have had the opportunity to go deeply into Salisbury, and there are places in town that are stunning because you folks have saved these homes. Talk about what having homes like these, and not just homes. So some of these are businesses, structures that were old. Talk about what that does to the character of a place.
It truly emphasizes the community and the connection that the community has to the built environment. It not only provides a quaint feel, one that's not so modern and washed out with the trappings of commercial commercialization. But I particularly do own a downtown building with my husband, and it just spending the time to put your own energy and funds into restoring what was there and has been there since this was 1919, and then seeing that being a vibrant part of the streetscape brings so much character to downtown Salisbury. And it's a lovely place to stroll and to meet your neighbors and to see your fellow community members who have businesses. And I think that truly brings people back to the community to spend their money and to support their neighbors.
These structures, I guess because of the architectural techniques of the time and the style of the time, are designed to be at a more human scale than, say, Manhattan or downtown Charlotte, where you can walk for a block or two and really not have anything to interact with visually until you go three stories up and look at the glass. And that does something for the human soul.
In fact, just this week, the American Planning Association just named downtown Salisbury as one of the top 10 great neighborhoods in the country to live.
Really?
Yes. So we've got a lot going on in Salisbury.
You're going to have a lot of visitors, and that means new buildings going up.
Well,
no, there's still much to restore.
Absolutely.
There are buildings available.
Okay.
And there can be a great merge.
This is the 37th annual October tour. It's hard if you do this every single year for 37 years. I would think it's hard to find something new to put on the tour, but I'm told that you've done it again this year. What is different about this tour this time?
I think the most significant property that is on tour this year that visitors will be so delighted to see is the newly restored Hambley Wallace House. It is stunning, and of course you can see photos of all of our sites on octobertour.com. But it is
And by the way, you can see them right now on WFAE.org. I just want to bring that up in case you're listening. You go to one of these websites,
right,
and you can see them. Go ahead.
Exactly. But that site, it has been open for tour in a few times in the past. However, the family, the Wallace family that owns this property, has just recently embarked in a full, glorious restoration. And it is stunning.
The Hambley Wallace House has come up a couple of times in this conversation, and this is the house that is referred to as Salisbury's castle. Mm-hmm. This is the house that I alleged in the beginning that perhaps it served as kind of a prototype or brought to people's vision what this kind of architecture was like, is like, and spread throughout the country during that period, correct?
Mm-hmm. That is correct. A man named E.B.C. Hambley employed a Charlotte architect, Charles Christian Hook, to design the house for him. He was project manager for the Whitney Project, which in the very early 1900s was on the Yadkin River. A place on the Yadkin, 1,500 feet wide, came down to 60 feet wide, and he wanted to harness that energy to get power for the power plants, to fund for cotton mills primarily. His house was built as a showplace to attract investors. But the Hambley project actually brought over $8 million into the community around real early 1900s.
Which is a fortune in that time.
Yes.
This is a 10, as I understand it, a 10,000 square foot home in the 16th century French chateau style. Mm-hmm. It's the only one of its kind in the Piedmont, correct? Mm-hmm.
To my knowledge, that is correct.
And it was said to have been built for $50,000. What would that be in today's money, $50,000?
Oh, goodness, I don't know.
Several million easily.
It would have to be because it is beautiful.
Yeah. And so that home today would be worth what? What it was worth then or more?
Much more, I think. I think especially after the restoration. I mean, this is a 21-room mansion, as Christine had mentioned. It's been on the tour in the 1990s, but only on the first level. And so you're actually going to see all three floors. And
Egbert Hambley. Egbert was his first name. I only bring it up because nobody's named Egbert anymore.
he was English.
Yes, he was English. He was from Cornwall in England. He died at 44 of typhoid fever and never saw the house to completion. This is one of those tragic stories that you hear about. And his widow sold the house later on. Why did he want to build such a house? Was he wealthy?
To attract investors for the Whitney Project. He was project manager for this massive dam that was built across the Yadkin River. And the idea of the dam was for energy. And as project manager, he had to bring money into the community, and this house was his showplace. He invited guests to come there and hoped that they would invest in his project.
And people can tour the yards, the gardens, and the entire house. It's the entire house will be
all open? Three floors.
Exactly. All three floors, newly restored. To an impeccable detail. It's just really lovely after the last time that it has been on tour, which was just the first floor. As Brian said, in the early 90s, they have painstakingly gone through every floor and really uncovered original features, and it added period fixtures and just designed the house and furnished it beautifully.
What are some of the other highlights? We kind of concentrated on the Hamblin Wallace house, but what are some of the other features of the tour that are highlights to you in your mind?
There are 12 sites total on tour. They span 1820 to 1924. We have a great selection of different styles, from Victorian to downtown commercial to colonial revival. It's a great opportunity to see commercial structures such as our Grimes Mill that is also open. But in addition to the sites, we offer a Civil War encampment where you can see both Union and Confederate troops that are shooting volley and showing what they've done, and they camp for a couple of days.
Salisbury was the site of a prison during the Civil War, wasn't it?
Yes, exactly.
How should people enjoy this? How should they attack? If you're coming from Charlotte or some other city around us and you're not a Salisburyan, is that how you say it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How would you enjoy this?
Well, it is set up mostly to be a walking tour. However, we have two trolleys that provide free service to tour goers to take you to any site. So you will purchase a ticket at octobertour.com. There are also tickets available to every tour site. And then you come to Salisbury and enjoy the heart of downtown.
And I have to stop you there. It's October 12th and 13th, octobertour.com. Thanks to Brian Davis, Christine Wilson, and Susan Sides for being here from Historic Salisbury Foundation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.